I recommend your eager attention as Brother Dan now expounds to us Isaiah 47 to the title, The Astonishing Decline of Babylon Foretold. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Brother James, and good evening, everyone. This is an incredible chapter, and I just hope that tonight I can portray the graphic and astonishing message which it gives to us. Isaiah gives to us 200 years before it even happened. It's all about the fall of Babylon, the city which went from being the greatest city on earth, the greatest city that the earth has ever seen, and that city was finally flattened. And that's what Isaiah is predicting in this prophecy. To start off with tonight, I want to give a synopsis of what the chapter is all about. Just briefly go through it and in simple terms describe what the verses are telling us. It's a fairly short chapter, so I've only got four sections, short sections, all of them. So let's just have a look at chapter 47 briefly to find out what it's talking about. So first of all, chapter 47, verse 1 to 5. We'll just read that section again. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal. Uncover thy locks. Make bare the leg. Uncover the thigh. Pass over the rivers. Thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, and thy shame shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not meet thee as a man. As for our Redeemer, Israel, Yahweh of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit thou silent, Babylon, and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms. So you see in verse 1 there's described to us a lady. She's a very eloquent lady. She's described as a virgin there. A very rich sort of woman that only the very best in society. She's described at the end of verse 1 as tender and delicate. She hasn't had to do much work in life. She's been born into a situation of riches. Life's been very easy for her. She enjoys the very best of everything. The best food, the best perfumes, etc. And if she wants anything, she just calls for a servant and they will do it for her. That's how Isaiah describes this city of Babylon, as a woman of that sort of kind, that sort of nature. And in verse 5, he says, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms. A dramatic change was to happen. No more was she to enjoy such luxury, such delicacies. Verse 2, she was to have to get used to hard work, to get used to being like everybody else, or even below everybody else, like a servant or a slave. The dramatic change in situation is described in verse 2. Take the millstones and grind meal. This is hard work now. Not the kind of easy lifestyle she enjoyed before. Life's no longer enjoyable. Has to be worked at. Uncover thy locks and make bare the leg. Uncover the thigh. Pass over the rivers. The gorgeous robes that she used to wear, well, they were to be stripped off. Instead, she was to wear rags to do the work of a servant. Clothes that would wear out and cause the legs to become bare. It's an incredible change. Verse 3, thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, thy shame shall be seen. She was to be like all the other nations, no longer the preeminent power amongst all the nations. No more of that. Just leveled to be like or even lower than the run-of-the-mill nations. And at the same time, verse 4, as Babylon's decline, Babylon's descent into obscurity, at the same time, Israel's fortunes would be restored. Bear in mind that when Isaiah spoke, Israel was quite comfortably, quite well off. They were under the rule of Hezekiah, 200 years before Babylon was destroyed. Israel hadn't gone into captivity, but implicit in verse 4 is the fact that terrible things would befall them. They would be taken away to captivity in Babylon. But as Babylon's situation got worse and worse, Israel's situation would not be left where it was. It would take a turn for the better. They would be redeemed from captivity, and Yahweh of hosts would save them. So let's just summarize simply what those verses are about. Verse 1 to 5. This is how I've described it. Babylon, from riches to rags. Or if you prefer something a little more formal to go in your margin, how about the title of the class, The Astonishing Decline of Babylon Foretold? Now, why was it that this was all to happen to Babylon? Why was it to be destroyed? To go from being the very first amongst the kingdoms to be leveled to the dust, to become nothing? Why was that? Why would God judge them? Well, the reasons are given firstly in verse 6, and then in the next section after that, verse 7 to 10. So these are the reasons why Babylon was to be judged. Verse 6, I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand. The wicked nation of Judah was to be judged by God. It hadn't happened yet, of course. They were wicked, and the Babylonians were the tool with which God used to punish Israel. They were to be judged by Babylon. But Babylon's attitude was wrong. They went too far. Rather than perceiving themselves as the tool in God's hand, they went further than that and demonstrated a cruel attitude, merciless, ruthless attitude to Israel. They went too far, and that's the first reason why God would judge them. The last half of the verse. Thou didst show them no mercy, Babylon. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. Old men, old women were showed no mercy by the soldiers of Babylon. They were cruelly hacked down and slaughtered in front of their family, in front of their relatives. It's terrible. No mercy was shown at all with Babylon. They enjoyed the bloodshed. They enjoyed this fierce sort of attitude. And so that was the first reason. Verse 6, their merciless attitude towards Judah. Ruthless, for those who've been on the study weekend. So that was one reason why Babylon was to be judged. The end of their city was coming for that reason. And why else? Verse 7 to 10. They were very arrogant. They had a great city. They felt that it was impossible to defeat, invincible. And they were very arrogant about that. They never thought they would ever see the end of this city. They thought it would continue forever. Verse 7. And thou hast said, I shall be a lady forever. So that thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, verse 1, tender and delicate, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of thy sorceries, and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. So first of all, they had this proud attitude. We will last forever. Babylon will be the eternal city. And they also had an education system in Babylon. People like the ones we read in verse 12. Astrologers. 13. So verse 13. Astrologers, stargazers, monthly prognosticators. Verse 12, they stood with their enchantments and sorceries. They had a great pride in the power they had developed and the learning within their own city. All the education and learning that they had developed there in Babylon. Many of them world firsts. Many of them having their roots still seen in universities of today, amazingly. So they were very proud and arrogant in their own self-sufficiency and the knowledge that they had developed. So let's summarize that. Verse 7 to 10. Their arrogant and self-confident manner. That was the second reason why God saw fit to judge this city, this empire of Babylon. Now, how was it to happen? How was this judgment of this mighty city, this citadel of Babylon, to happen? How would it happen? Verse 11 to 15. It would be sudden, in one moment, in one day, and it would be irresistible. They would make vain attempts to thwart the onslaught of God's judgment, but it would be no good. They would not be able to resist it. See what I mean in verse 11. Therefore shall evil come on thee. Thou shalt not know from whence it riseth. It was to be a surprise. They weren't to be aware of what was happening. And mischief shall fall on thee. Thou shalt not be able to put it off. And desolation shall come on thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. Stand now, invites God. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast labored from thy youth. If so be, thou shalt be able to profit. If so be, thou mayest prevail. So God says it's going to happen suddenly. You won't be able to do a thing about it. There'll be no stopping this judgment. No putting it off for a few days, a few hours. It will happen, and you won't even know that it's happening. And also, he predicts in verse 12 that they would try. Their wise men, their sorcerers, etc., would try. They would be looked to in this day, but it would be no good. They would fail. So the final section of the chapter, verse 11 to 15, judgment upon Babylon, sudden and irresistible. I think I've spelt the last word right. Somebody tell me if I haven't. So that's the chapter in summary, a very brief summary of it all. Now, as I said at the outset of the class, this was an incredible event. In fact, I'd go as far as to say that, apart from the flood, this was the most incredible event in the history, the whole history of the world. And I want you to understand why. Here's an artist's impression of the city of Babylon. In fact, that's only half of it, as I'll point out later. Huge walls, a massive city. So there's a brief depiction of it. And I also want to describe what the city was like, some of the details that were found in the city. and we'll use the whiteboard to do this. Some of the geographical features of the city of Babylon. Now, obviously, historians of old who were describing their own city tended to exaggerate a bit, but I'll give you the details as they record them. In fact, Roland, who I've been reading, says that he presents the figures as they are, although he thinks they should be toned down a little bit to make them more believable. But be that as it may, I'll describe it as I've read it. Babylon was a square city, a bit like Adelaide, except much bigger. 225 times bigger, in fact. Because it was 15 miles square. So that side was 15 miles, and that side was 15 miles. It stood on a large, fertile plain, so they had plenty of means to grow crops, you know, do the agriculture, make ornate sort of gardens, make it a very beautiful looking place. But they had plenty of means to supply that huge city and all the inhabitants. The walls of the city were huge. They were immense. Roland says they were 87 feet thick and 350 feet high. So that's the height of those walls there. That's immense. I haven't checked the details, but I don't think the Santos building in the middle of town would be that tall, 350 feet. I'm not sure. But just think of that, going for 15 miles each way around a city. So that's 60 miles to go around the perimeter of a city. Walls as high as that, right the way round. And 87 feet thick. That's an incredible thickness. As well as that, it was surrounded by a vast ditch. So all around the city, like that, there was a huge ditch. In fact, that's where they got the bricks from to build the city. They dug the mud out of this ditch here. They dug the mud from there, and that's what they used to make the bricks to build the city. So that means the volume of the walls is equal to the volume of the ditch. It gives you an idea of the size of this ditch that went all the way round the city of Babylon. I think Nathan Taylor enjoyed that arithmetic then. So there was this huge ditch, which was a wonderful defense for the city. To attack the city, you had to get across this. You had to get over this ditch. So in itself, not even taking the walls into consideration, this was a fantastic defense for the city. It seemed unconquerable, didn't it? Now, along each of the walls, on every side, there were 25 gates. So along here, there were 25 gates, making 100 gates in total around the city. And those gates were made of brass. That was the way into and out of the city. That's how the city communicated with the outside world, I suppose. And there were two special gates over the river, which we'll come to later. So 25 gates all around the walls of the city, and leading from one to the other were streets, very wide, broad avenues. I think they were about 150 feet broad from memory. So right across the city there were these streets, like that. 25 running from east to west, and 25 running from north to south. I'll spare you by not drawing them all. But it divides the city into a sort of gridiron pattern that we're used to in many, many modern cities today. But there was a difference. By the way, I should say that each of these square blocks was half a mile by half a mile. So that's quarter of the city of Adelaide, to put it in our terms. About half a mile across. So from West Terrace to King William Street, if that's the one that goes through the centre, and the same in the upwards direction from South Terrace. So those are large blocks, aren't they? And around the outside of these blocks, in fact, there are 676 of them in total, a great number of them. Around the outside, that's where the houses were, where they lived, like that. The houses were just on the edge, facing out onto the streets. And that left a vast tract, a vast area of ground in the middle of that square. And that's where they were able to grow their crops and plant their gardens, etc. It was said that half of the city of Babylon appeared to be green. So half of it was urbanized with houses, temples, bridges, that sort of thing. And the other half of it could be used for agriculture. And that's why it was said that Babylon could last in a siege for 20 years if they needed to. Because most of the land within their city was very rich and fertile and available to be used for growing food for the city. And it was never tried, but it was said that Babylon would be able to last 20 years if there was a siege. That was the estimate. So it's a very useful design of the city from that respect. So that's some detail on the city of Babylon. Now, another important feature was the river, which it wasn't the river Euphrates, but just a branch of the river Euphrates. And that ran from the north side, right across the city, to the south side, like that. So running through the city was the river. And there was a bridge across the river somewhere. And that's what we could see on the picture. Perhaps this makes a little more sense now. So on the overhead, which is on the screen there, we can actually only see half of the city. We're looking up from this direction. You can just make out the bridge. And we can only see half of the city, if that, because it seems to extend further out towards us in that projection. So we're looking up along the river, this branch of the river Euphrates. Now, of course, the streets, which were leaning across the city, they came to the river at these 25 points. And at each of those 25 points was access to the river. This is important detail because this is the key to how Cyrus took the city. There were these 25 gates along this side of the river because of the 25 streets, and likewise there were 25 along the other side. And that was the access from the street level to the city. I'll just draw a third diagram on the board. We're going to have a cross section up the river, where the river and street, where they meet, where they interface with each other. So you've got the riverbed of the Euphrates like this. That's the river. It'd be nice to have it in blue, but we've got it in black. On the side of the river, there's what's known as quays, Q-U-A-Y-S. And that's a landing area where you could land your boat and you could get out onto flat ground without having a wall looming right above your head as soon as you landed. So that's like a docking area to make it convenient and easy for the boats to access the city. Now, there are walls on the side of the quays. Equal in dimensions to the wall that ran along the side of the city. I guess that should end there, shouldn't it? I didn't do art at school. The street level was slightly above the level of the river. So it's like that. And the same on the other side. So these are huge walls, bear in mind, 87 feet thick. The river was about 200 metres wide. And they were 350 feet high. Huge walls. There was no chance of getting into the city if they kept it locked up properly, was there? And at each of the 50 points. There were steps leading down through the walls. And I guess there was an archway there and there. Steps leading down on either side so you could access the river. Just at these 25 points. And to guard the passageway, there were gates of brass here and here. They were supposed to be kept open in the day, which they were, and closed at night. And they kept that up rigorously, apart from one fateful day when they left them open. And that's when Cyrus attacked. If those gates hadn't been left open, he would never have got into the city. But of course, the angels of God were supervising it so that those gates were left open. And Cyrus succeeded. What else do I have? We saw in the picture the bridge that went across the river. That was built later on. And also, to do this, the queen at the time was a queen by the name of Nitocris, or something like that. And on the west of the city of Babylon, she built this huge basin, a gigantic basin, to hold the water of the river while it was diverted. So you couldn't do any engineering work like building bridges or putting bricks to shore up the side of these quays. You couldn't do that while the river was in full flow. So what this Queen of Babylon did, she built this basin, diverted the river there, and so the riverbed was dry, and her engineers were free to build the bridge and do all the other work that they needed to do. And that came in very useful later to Cyrus, for a different reason. So that's an important feature to remember. Some other things which I've jotted down. To the north, way to the north of Babylon, they built canals to guard against when the city flooded, and they would divert the Euphrates River to the Tigris nearby. Two great rivers of the world. Some amazing engineering projects going on. They weren't stupid in Babylon, were they? They achieved some amazing things, incredible things. They didn't have the equipment that we have today, but they still achieved all of this. They also had the Hanging Gardens in Babylon, which are noted in history as one of the seven wonders of the world. This is interesting, because this is equal to this. That tower there. Very good to point my finger. That tower there is equal to what I just put up on the screen. The very same thing. Remember last time's chapter was about the god Bel. And I think this is the temple to worship him. It was a huge building, bigger than any of the Egyptian pyramids. That's the kind of thing they were capable of building in Babylon. Many think that this was similar or the same as the Tower of Babel. Perhaps the Tower of Babel evolved from this very building. Said that the wrong way around. Other way around it should be. But that's some of the incredible architecture that was in Babylon. That building is 300 feet high. The base is 300 feet wide, square, pyramid. And the courtyard is a quarter of a mile square. Huge. All of that area given up to a temple for one of the gods of Babylon, the principal god. Here's a very famous piece of Babylonian history, architecture. This is known as the Ishtar Gate. It was the only thing that was left even partially standing when Babylon was excavated. The only thing. If you ever get a chance to go to Britain, you can see some things that they've dug up from Babylon in the British Museum there. This one is in Berlin, though, I think. So the Germans have got this one, Uncle Irwin. This is in Berlin, the Ishtar Gate. And from it, you can actually gauge the sort of character of Babylon. They had time to engage in art. This isn't paint on the bricks. It's carefully worked enamel to make all of those patterns. They had lots of time to give to the arts because they were a city of pleasure and luxury. They didn't have to worry about the cares of life like the other nations did. They were very rich. And so I hope this has given you a sort of quality of what the city was like, an idea of the quality of what the city was like. An amazing city. And Isaiah says, "For thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate." Let's just turn to Isaiah 47 and have a look at some of the detail there. That's the first point I've tried to impress upon your minds. The greatness, the wonder of this city of Babylon. How impressive it would have appeared to people. And Judah knew this. They'd sent their envoys, their messengers, and some of them had been privileged to see this great city. They knew about it. Tender and delicate. And that answers to verse 8. "Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly." It's their easy, materialistic, well-off way of life. An amazing standard of living in that city. Verse 3, Babylon was to have this veneer of dignity which it had for so many years. It was to have that stripped away and to become as one of the other nations. It's a very difficult phrase at the end of verse 3, where it says, "I will take vengeance and I will not meet thee as a man." What on earth does that mean? The most helpful translation I could find was from the NRSV, and so the RSV is probably similar, although I don't have that to check. And this is what the NRSV said. Instead of, "I will not meet thee as a man," it says, "I will spare no one." And that seems to make the verse read much more sensibly, to my mind anyway. "I will spare no one." This idea of vengeance upon Babylon, let's just turn up some other quotes. Jeremiah 51, verse 11. Verse 11, "Make bright the arrows, gather the shields. Yahweh hath raised up the spirit of the kings of the Medes, for his device is against Babylon, to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of Yahweh, the vengeance of his temple, which they were to destroy." Jeremiah 50, verse 18, so just back a page. "Therefore, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land, as I have punished the king of Assyria. And I will bring Israel again to his habitation, and he shall feed on Carmel and Bashan, and his soul shall be satisfied upon Mount Ephraim and Gilead." See that? That's exactly the same thought as Isaiah chapter 41. Babylon's doom against Israel's redemption. Rejoicing, deliverance. So Babylon's doom in verse 18 and verse 19 is Israel's deliverance. Very similar passage in Isaiah 14 as well. This is also about the fall of Babylon, of course. About the way Babylon would be stripped of all its dignity and power and wealth. Be humbled. Isaiah 14, verse 10. "And they shall speak and say unto thee, Art thou also become weak as we? Art thou become like unto us? Thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy vials. The worm is spread under thee, and the worms cover thee. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend unto heaven." There's the pride again. So there are other verses corresponding to Isaiah chapter 47 that build up this picture of Babylon's doom. Isaiah 47 verse 1, if you remember, said, "For thou shalt be called tender and delicate." A very interesting quotation from the historian Roland. Thou shalt be called tender and delicate. This is when Cyrus came upon the city of Babylon and he was deciding what to do. He was trying to rally his troops. I'll just describe what Cyrus did. There's Cyrus, one person, and he chose out 200 very elite men. They were to be his chief captains. And to each of those 200, he said, I want you to choose four men, four of the very best men that you can. So there is another 800. So we're up to 1,001. The one is very significant. And then to each of those 1,000, he said, I want you to choose each one a stone slinger. And there's three types. Can't remember exactly. Probably cavalry and people who can hurl pikes. Oh, here it is. Just for interest. Pikemen, slingers, and bowmen. So that made up the army of 1,000 times 10 times 3. That's how he made up his army. So by that method, he hoped to achieve a great army by selecting the most elite men he could, and they would then in turn select elite men, and they in turn would select specialists at particular jobs. But it's to those 200 first officers that he speaks in this quote. His close circle of officers. Now listen to this in the light of, for thou shalt be called tender and delicate. This is Cyrus speaking. Do you know, says he to them, the nature of the enemy you have to deal with? They are soft, effeminate, enervated men, already half conquered by their own luxury and voluptuousness. Men not able to bear either hunger or thirst, equally incapable of supporting either the toil of war or the sight of danger. Whereas you, that are inured from your infancy to a sober and hard way of living, to you, I say, hunger and thirst are but the source, the only source to your meals. Fatigues are your pleasures, danger your delight, and the love of your country and of glory your only passion. So Cyrus himself picked up the effeminate and delicate way of living that even the soldiers of Babylon had become used to. It's an interesting quote in the light of Isaiah 47, verse 1. Hopefully I've created in your minds a picture of this city of Babylon, this incredible city, and a perception of its invincibility. How could Babylon be conquered? How could it? How could Babylon sit in the dust and have its throne removed? How was it possible? If, just imagine for a moment, if you are the general given this responsibility of taking the city of Babylon, what would you do? What would be your strategy? How would you conquer Babylon? I think without choosing Cyrus's plan, because that was the first time it had ever been thought of in history, and I don't think has ever been used since, to dry up the river, or at least reduce the river, and get into the city that way. Apart from that, how would you conquer Babylon? It could outlast a siege for 20 years. The defences of the city were incredible. If you could get across the moat, then there was the wall to contend with. It was almost impossible to think that the city could be taken by storm. And if you were to try besieging the city, they could last for 20 years. With an army that you had motivated to have the best intentions of destroying the city of Babylon, 40-year-old generals would go to that city, and if they finally succeeded, there would be 60-year-olds, their life almost gone. Young men in their 20s who are called to be part of your army, if they went to be part of this siege, then all their time with their growing families, the prime of their life would be lost, wasted in this siege. Well, not wasted, because they would conquer a great city if they succeeded. And anyway, for 20 years, could you motivate an army? Could you keep them from losing their their enthusiasm for the battle. Surely they would, after 20 years, they would be desperate to get home. They would be fed up with the course. It was terrible to think of this responsibility of conquering Babylon. How on earth could it be done? In fact, the very plan which Cyrus chose was doomed to failure if the Babylonians had their wits about them. All they had to do was close those 50 gates by the side of the river, and Cyrus's army was doomed. In the morning, there would be breakfast for the fish. The Babylonians would look from the walls, close their gates, shoot with their arrows, and drive Cyrus's army, the Persians, back into the river. But it succeeded because the hand of God was with them. So it's an amazing event, isn't it, the taking of this city, actually managing to conquer and subdue this city and get into there and do that. Just some verses now to go against Isaiah 47, verse 6, the cruelty of Babylon. So, back to Isaiah 47, verse 6. The way that they showed Judah, the Israelites, God's people, they showed them no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. Four quotations to highlight the sort of things the Babylonians did. The last chapter of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 36. Second Chronicles 36, verse 17. Because of the nation of Judah's hard heart, their deaf ears when the prophets came to them, they wouldn't listen to God's words. Because of that, verse 17, therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young man or maiden. They even killed the women, not just the young soldiers. They killed women. Old men, or him that stooped for age, defenseless old people, just hacked down by the swords of the Babylonians. He gave them all into his hand. There's an illustration of the fierceness, the cruelty of this nation, Babylon. How about Psalm 137? Famous psalm. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept. Remember that one? Well, at the end of Psalm 137, in verse 8, it says, O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou had served us. What Babylon had done to others would be returned upon their own heads. And this is what they'd given. This is some of what they'd given to others. Verse 9. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Young children, babies, picked up by Babylonian soldiers and thrown, hurled against walls, head first. No mercy. That's the way they acted, these Babylonians. Unbelievable cruelty. Isaiah 13. You can see why God judged them if they had an attitude like that. Yes, Judah was wicked and deserved to be punished, but the Babylonians went too far in their fury. They loved the war. Probably only because they came after the Assyrians, they weren't noted for them. The Assyrians were particularly cruel, and the Babylonians followed them. And they weren't especially noted like the Assyrians were. Isaiah 13, verse 15 to 18. Returned upon Babylon would be the evil, the cruelty which they had dished out to others. Isaiah 13, verse 15. Everyone that is found, chapters about Babylon, verse 1, the burden of Babylon. Now verse 15. Everyone that is found shall be thrust through, and everyone that is joined unto them shall fall by their sword. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled, their wives ravished. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver. And as for gold, they shall not delight in it. Their bows also shall dash the young men to pieces, and they shall have no pity. On the fruit of the womb, their eye shall not spare children. Just as Babylon had done, that's what they'd get. A very interesting comment in Zechariah chapter 1, verse 15. Israel and Judah were the people of God, and high standards were expected of them. The nations around them also had standards that God expected them to live up to. Not as noble as he had given to Israel and Judah, but he still required a sense of dignity and properness and righteousness from them too. The other nations, Amos chapter 1 is a good example of that. Various nations being judged for different evils which they performed. God expected things of them, expected them to know a certain amount about him because of their proximity to the nation of Israel. Zechariah chapter 1 verse 15. And I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. He was a lot displeased with Judah, but he was also displeased with the heathen nations because they helped forward the affliction. They delighted in it, and God would judge them for that. So that was the cruelty of Babylon, and I've gone through that fairly quickly because I think it's easy to grasp. The other thing they were judged for was their arrogant attitude. Now have a look at this in Isaiah chapter 47. They expected their wonderful city, which they had been so ingenious to create, to build, they expected that it would last forever. It couldn't be defeated in their minds. Verse 7, and thou saidst, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither did remember the latter end of it. There's their arrogant attitude depicted. Now, how about this? We'll just set up the situation first of all. Do you remember in chapter 45? Yes, chapter 45. There was that repeated phrase. For example, I can see it in verse 14 at the end. This is God speaking about his supremacy. End of verse 14. Chapter 45, verse 14. Surely God is in thee, and there is none else. There is no God. God's unrivaled position as supreme occurs many times through the chapter. I wish I had my other Bible because that's where I've coloured it in. This page is pure white. Let me drop my eye up and on another few of those. Okay, help. Help. Verse 21. 18. There we are. It's a good test that you were listening. I was 5 and 6. Okay, let's just read those out. Yes, verse 5. I am Yahweh, there is none else. There is no God beside me. End of verse 6. I am Yahweh, there is none else. Nathan, what did you say, verse 15? 18. End of verse 18. I am Yahweh, there is none else. And Samuel? 21. Twice. I'll just go for the one because that's what I've got my eye on. There is no God else beside me, a just God and a Saviour. There is none else beside me. And I know there's one in chapter 46, verse 9. There's lots. Verse 9 of chapter 46. I am God, there is none like me. Get the point? God is supreme. Nobody like him. Now what does Babylon say in chapter 47? Verse 8, in the middle of the verse, thou sayest in thine heart, I am and none else beside me. It's an echo of that very phrase from that we were just looking at before. How arrogant is that to compare themselves to God, to set themselves up as his rival? It's there again in verse 10 at the end. Very last sentence of verse 10. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am and none else beside me. How about that? How about that for arrogance? It's unbelievable, isn't it? And because of that, the judgment of Babylon would come very quickly. Be a big surprise for them. They would be terribly judged. Let's just emphasize the suddenness of their judgment. Verse 9 of Isaiah 47. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day. One day for the destruction of that city. One day to enter the city, find the king, destroy it, subdue all the inhabitants of the city and get them to respond to your command as supreme, to respond to your authority, respect that from that day onwards. One day to do all of that. It's incredible. It's what Isaiah said 200 years before it happened. And remember, Babylon was just one of a pack of nations. There's nothing really special in Isaiah's day. It's just emerging. And Isaiah, first of all, he said Babylon would become great because they would be called the Lady of Kingdoms, this elegant, lovely, suave lady. That's what Babylon was to become. And he also says that city would be destroyed so quickly. One day, he says. And he says it again in verse 11. Therefore shall evil come upon thee, thou shalt not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall fall upon thee, and thou shalt not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. Again, that's the surprise, the suddenness of it all. Babylon was not to be expecting this invasion, according to Isaiah. Those chapters in Jeremiah, chapter 51 and 50 again, right at the end of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 51 verse 8 says, Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed. Howl for her, take balm for her pain. If so be, she may be healed. There's the suddenness of it. Again in 50 verse 24, back one page. I have laid a snare for thee, and thou art taken. Thou art also taken, O Babylon, and thou wast not aware. Thou art found and also caught, because thou hast striven against Yahweh, weren't aware of what was coming upon them. It's an incredible prediction from Isaiah, isn't it? Spoke this 200 years before, remember. Incredible words. How would you respond to that message if you were living in Jerusalem at that time? If Isaiah came out onto the street and said, Babylon will emerge as the greatest nation. Point two, Babylon will be destroyed and it will take one day. How would you respond to that if you are faithful? One of the few faithful in Israel, that would be difficult to believe, wouldn't it? What if you were one of the other people in the nation of Judah? How would you receive that? If you were a skeptic already? Babylon is to become a great nation. Okay. Okay, Isaiah. It's emerging. Babylon is to be destroyed. But Isaiah, haven't you heard the reports of that city? The walls are 87 feet wide. They drive horses along the top, and the horse, four of them abreast, and they have room to turn on the wall. 87 feet thick. The walls are 350 feet high, Isaiah. And what's more, this wall goes around the city 15 miles on each side, so that's a total of 60 miles, Isaiah. And you think the city will be destroyed. There's a moat around the outside of Babylon, by the way, Isaiah. It's very deep, and the walls are vertical. How do you explain your comment? How do you explain that Babylon will be destroyed? And, Isaiah, this is preposterous. You've given a day for the whole operation. I like you, Isaiah, but you're rather optimistic. Actually, Isaiah, I think you're ridiculous. I don't believe a word of your prophecy, and this just proves that you're mad, you're crazy, and I will not listen to you one day. But it was true. It actually happened in one day. In fact, it didn't even take one day. It took a few hours. Unbelievable, isn't it? And this was all from a viewpoint 200 years before. One day for that to fall. I need to run through very quickly, so I've just noted down some points on the taking of Babylon. I'll just read them out. Not that many of them. And then I'd like to read out a quote from a historian. So Cyrus' first idea was to take the city by siege. He didn't think of the river strategy first of all. He first thought to take it by siege. And he was horrified when he arrived. He realized the siege would never work. Or at least it would take a lot of time and effort for his army. And so the strategy of diverting this river into the basin that the queen that I mentioned earlier, Nitocris, something like that, into the basin that she had constructed. Divert the river into there. Dry it up and you can march under the gates and come into the city that way. Now, he took up that idea, kept it secret. He pretended, even to his own army, and to the Babylonians, that he was doing something else. He needed to dig trenches to do this. Now, if you start digging a trench, you end up with a pile of dirt here. If you start digging a mound of dirt, you end up with a trench. So what are you doing? Are you digging a trench or are you building a mound? That was the ideal thing that worked in Cyrus's favor. Understand that? What I'm saying is... What am I saying? Cyrus tried to make it look that he was building up blockades against the city of Babylon, building some mounds of dirt, when in fact he wasn't doing that at all. He was building the trenches that would carry the water to divert the river into this other place to the west of the city. And Babylon was totally fooled. They stood on the walls and laughed at his efforts. You'd never succeed. I don't know how they thought that. There was this great moat to come across, and he's building mounds of dirt on the other side of that. I don't think they would have approached the size of the walls very quickly. That's what he tried to make it look like anyway, and he succeeded. Now, it came to Cyrus's attention that a feast was to be held in the city of Babylon. And it was no longer a problem for Cyrus to pick the day of his invasion. Didn't need to toss a coin about this, because during the feast, the city celebrated with great drunkenness and revelry. The whole city was given to confusion. And Cyrus thought, right, that's the day that I'll choose. No question about it. That's the day my operation begins to happen. And so the feast began to happen on the given day that had been mentioned to Cyrus. And in the general negligence and disorder of the night, those gates on the side of the river, the 25 brass gates, were left wide open. Have a look at Isaiah chapter 45. The gates were left open. They were open during the day and they were supposed to be shut during the night. And they did that rigorously for however many years. Except they forgot on this night. Now look at Isaiah 45, verse 1. Thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, he's named 200 years before for a start, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of king, to open before him the two-leaved gates, the gates that guarded the river, the entrance of the river, first of all. Open them up for you, Cyrus, and the gates shall not be shut. I will loose the loins of kings. I will open the gates. Verse 2, I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, those 50 gates that line the side of the river, to be left open by the angel which went in front of Cyrus's army. And so the river began to sink, and in marched Cyrus. We'll read of that drama from this book. In and around the book of Babylon, the historian's actually called Xenophon. Somebody's thinking of Nick, I think. Where do I start? Okay. According then to Xenophon, Cyrus, impressed by the strength and height of the fortifications, thought first of starving out the city. Remember I said that? He thought first to lay a siege of the city. But when the river was mentioned to him and some comment made on its depth, he conceived the idea of draining off its waters by digging a trench round the town, and at the same time leading the Babylonians to believe that he was preparing to blockade their city. See, I didn't make it up. By forming a rampart with the earth thrown up out of the trench. This indeed they believed, and in the words of the historian, laughed at his blockade as being furnished with provisions for more than 20 years. After the trench was dug, Cyrus, according to Xenophon, on hearing that there was a festival in Babylon, which all the Babylonians drank and reveled the whole night, took, during the time of it, a number of men with him. And as soon as it was dark, good time to do it when it's dark, because they didn't have lights, remember? And so you couldn't see what was happening. Was the river sinking, or were you just imagining it? And they were drunk anyway, so they could have believed anything, I suppose. Nighttime, a good time to do it. Open the trenches on the side towards the river. And when this was done, the water ran off into the night to the trenches, and the bed of the river through the city became traversable. After sending a force of men to test the depth of the river, on their reporting favorably, Cyrus addressed his officers and assured them they would find little difficulty in overcoming a foe whom they had already defeated when sober. He defeated Babylon outside the walls. They had retreated inside the city, so there had been a first skirmish, a first battle, and Cyrus had won easily. They were a useless army, too busy doing other things in life, I suppose. He concluded his address with the words, "Hasten therefore to arms." And so Cyrus lowered the wall of the city, marched in unopposed to that great city of Babylon with its huge walls and fortifications. No opposition all the way to the king's palace, the royal palace. And he burst in through those doors, and this is where Daniel 5 comes in. That's the chapter of the Bible that was happening at precisely that moment. Burst in there, and the king and his small band of guards were around him to protect him. Actually, the king, what's his name? Belshazzar. He'd recovered a bit from his terrible feebleness and weakness, the shaking knees, and he was there with his sword drawn in his hand. But that was no problem to these soldiers. Cyrus's soldiers dealt with them quickly, marched through the city, killed anyone they found in the streets, and told everyone to give up their weapons and arms, and told them all to stay in their city. It just happened like that, so quickly, a few hours. Isaiah was right, it all took one day, less in fact. Who would have believed that? Isn't that an incredible event in history? Incredible. Remember that verse in Isaiah 47? Don't turn it up. But they would resort to their wise men, sorcerers, etc., etc., monthly prognosticators. Have a look at Daniel chapter 5. This was the very time that we're talking about. It is, of course, the chapter which speaks of the writing that went up on the wall. Excuse me. When the hand went up, for example, verse 5, the king saw the part of the hand that wrote at the end of verse 5. What did he do? He trembled. What does it say about his knees smote one against the other? The joints of his loins were loosed. And what did he do when he'd recovered a bit of sanity, a bit of strength of mind? What did he do? Who did he resort to? Verse 7. The writing's already gone up. Verse 7, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Exactly what Isaiah said. It's amazing, isn't it? Verse 8, then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Verse 15 again. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing, and make known to me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. He resorted to those wise men, the soothsayers, sorcerers, etc. All of those who had this knowledge of Babylon, they'd been learning it all their lives. And it didn't matter a scrap. Couldn't do a thing about it. They were useless. Isaiah had said that. Now, that's the taking of Babylon, but the city survived for a good many years after this. How come that Isaiah said, O virgin or daughter of Babylon, come down and sit in the dust? There's more to come for this city of Babylon, isn't there? It's not the end of the story yet. And again, this historian, Roland, has got amazing detail about how this happened. This was reduced to rubble. Would you believe it? But it was what Isaiah had said, come down and sit in the dust. He said it in other chapters too, which we shall look at in a moment. Now, I've enumerated some points of how this gradual decline of Babylon took place over many years. Point one, after Cyrus had taken the city, Babylon ceased from being a royal city. So it lost its real position of importance at the head of the empire. No more a royal city. The kings of Persia preferred cities like Susa and Persepolis, which you may have heard of. Persepolis is particularly famous. Point two, the Macedonians, now I didn't really understand that detail of history. It went from being under Persian kings to Macedonians, which is near Greece, and then back to Persian kings again. So that's a detail of history which puzzled me. Anyway, the Macedonians had rule over Babylon next. And they neglected Babylon, built another city called Seleucia in the neighborhood, and their purpose was expressly to draw away its inhabitants and make Babylon deserted. They wanted the doom of Babylon, these Macedonians. So they built a rival city. Come on, people of Babylon, come and live in this city instead. And many of them did. Not all of them, though. Thirdly, there were new kings of Persia. So back to kings of Persia again. And they completed the ruin of the city of Babylon by building another city called Ctesiphon. Very curious spelling, so I'll write it up. So another city goes up in the neighborhood, and they carried away the remaining inhabitants of Babylon to this other city. Nobody left in Babylon. Completely deserted, only walls left around the outside. Nobody living there. This once great, magnificent city. I guess it still had all the architecture and the wonders. Standing in the city, nobody lived there. Nobody lived there to enjoy all of that. Completely empty. Now, point five, the kings of Persia made a park of it. They loved hunting, They thought, what better place to keep our animals than in this city of Babylon? We'll keep our wild animals there, and when we feel like hunting one or two, we know where they are. We can get out our bows and arrows and go and shoot one or two. So they kept wild beasts in this city of Babylon for their hunting. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 21. I think I would have been tempted to keep Babylon in its full glory, but that's not what God intended. He intended its doom, its destruction, its complete and utter destruction. And so he must have worked in the minds of all these kings and rulers to give them the type of disposition that hated Babylon, to do all these things to it, to despise the city, leave it go to wreck and ruin. So the city was like a zoo, or worse, because it was wild beasts, not domestic tame beasts. Wild beasts running around inside the city for the pleasure of hunting for the Persian kings. Isaiah 13, verse 21. Take verse 19 for context. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation, neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and the wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. Who would have thought that that marvelous city would have wild animals running around in it, like Isaiah had said? Wouldn't you have thought Isaiah was crazy to make such a prediction? It happened just like he said, 200 years in advance. Here's a quote from a book. Babylon was now the retreat of fierce, savage, deadly creatures that hate the light and delight in darkness. Hardly tender and delicate anymore. Couldn't really describe it like that at this stage, with wild beasts roaming around, ready to pounce on anyone who would try to enter the city. Not very tender and delicate, is it, anymore? But that's not the last of it. Seventh, parts of the wall began to fall down and were never repaired by the kings that ruled over it. Various accidents and the passing time of the centuries destroyed the remainder of the walls. Very little left of the walls. Eventually, even the animals abandoned the place. Only creatures like serpents and scorpions remained, and it was a dreadful place to visit. You daren't go there to investigate the city of Babylon, to see its remains excavated and stuff like that. The river Euphrates no longer had a free channel. It was all overgrown. The walls fallen down into the river everywhere. Undergrowth growing everywhere. The river Euphrates no longer had a free channel. It couldn't pass through the city like it had in its grandeur, the time of old. And so the river, as they do, found another way, took another course. And there was just a pool of stagnant water left from the river that had once flowed through that city. Alexander the Great came along, and he began a project to restore the river to its original channel, try and get Babylon going again. But God obviously intervened. He'd said it wouldn't be built again, so he wouldn't allow Alexander to complete his project, and he died prematurely. And that was the end of that project. The river was just left to run its course, the different course that it had chosen. Eventually, the river became transformed to an inaccessible pool. We're in Isaiah chapter 13. Have a look at chapter 14, verse 23. Verse 22, so you can see that it is Babylon. For I will rise up against them, saith Yahweh of hosts, and cut off from Babylon the name and remnant and son and nephew, saith Yahweh. So it's about Babylon. And what would happen? I will make it also a possession for the bittern and pools of water. That's what it became. Literally became pools of water. Stagnant, stinking, smelly water was what this once glorious city was now at. I will sweep it with the besom of destruction, saith Yahweh of hosts. And he did. Eventually, Babylon became an utter desert. It's in Iraq today, and that's how it appears currently. And all the country round about fell into the same state of desolation and horror. So it was a desert, and around it was a waste, howling wilderness. And Isaiah 47 said, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. And to the word, that's what happened. Exactly to the letter of the word, that's what happened. Unbelievable. Now, I did have some quotes to go to in Revelation, because that's quoted. Isaiah 47 is quoted in Revelation. I don't really have time to do it in detail. Let's just go there quickly and see the similarity. I'll read out the verse first of all, while you're returning to Revelation. This is the verse that is quoted in Revelation 18. It's Isaiah 47, verse 8. I am and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. That's what Isaiah 47 said. Revelation 18 says, verse 7, how much she hath glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her, for she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. So it's directly quoted from Isaiah chapter 47. Now here are some of the similarities which are